Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Eavesdrop with us this hour on the COVID question, the lab leak mystery that is finally front and center and making a lot of the experts squirm. It's about where and how the coronavirus made contact with people. Is this merciless pandemic revealing nature's way with viruses, or the hand of science reaching far beyond its grasp without even counting the risks? We're listening in on a meta-novelist, a Singapore biologist in a Cambridge lab, and a scoop artist high in scientific journalism, all of them puzzling where the killer coronavirus came from. And we're engaging one of the rare American scientists who tried to steer his colleagues off a path to disaster, Richard Ebright.
This is not world versus China. This is not the U.S. versus China. This is a matter that engages decisions made both by the U.S. and by China, and by France, and by other nations. This was an international project. Why was the decision made to fund this research without performing a risk-benefit assessment?
First, three meaning makers are working the mystery with one another by various indirections. Nicholson Baker leads off. He's the novelist beyond category and historian, most recently of the drive to build an American germ warfare program after World War II. In New York Magazine last winter, Nick Baker, you breathed life into this origin story, deconstructing evidence that was never quite there. What was the question that got you going?
I was trying to write with a certain amount of humility because obviously we do not know the answers. We don't have enough fact to chew on, really, but I wanted to know what happened like everybody else. Why did this trouble, this infection, seem so perfectly hyper-adapted to human beings, and why did it spread so quickly? But you have to be very careful, first of all, to say that we don't actually know what the Chinese scientists were doing. We just know what research papers they've published. Hmm? And there were a lot of really smart scientists that said that this so-called gain of function, this kind of research that tried to amp up viruses and make them more transmissible and contagious, that this was a mistake. And that was what they were protesting beginning in 2012, 2013, something like that. And then 2014, there was a pause. The pause was then lifted in the early period of the Trump administration. But even before that, certain laboratories like Ralph Baric's laboratory in North Carolina had some of its gain-of-function research sort of grandfathered in. So there was a huge kind of context of high-risk experimentation in these viruses. And that's the part that interested me.
Nick, what I found, and you discovered in great depth, was that it was a familiar issue among American biologists. A lot of them opposed it in private. All said that it was, in fact, banned research in the United States, but it had been commissioned to China. There were some who were working in it who were enthusiastic. There were a very few, Richard Ebright of Rutgers, who were outspoken against it, but nobody wanted to talk about it. How did you break through?
Well, the scientists were very, and still are very, reluctant to talk about it. Mark Lipsitch, who is someone I greatly admire, wanted to stay out of it. And I understand that, you know, because you're in the middle of a disease, you're in the middle of a time when people are dying. We had a completely crazy, nutty, clownish president. So everything was complicated by politics. So somebody like Lipsitch said, I'll just concentrate on trying to do whatever I can do to have fewer people die. I understood that perfectly. Ebright has been in this battle about funding risky research really since the year 2000. And basically he said that when he heard that there was this new disease that had emerged from a laboratory in Wuhan that he'd been warning about, in which there was a new kind of very contagious disease, that it screamed lab leak to him. That's what he wrote me.
You've cued me to enlist Alina Chan. With your mastery of the bioscience and, strikes me as remarkable, confidence and courage, you have made this COVID origin story a mass participation event on Twitter. your own Twitter account may be the medium of the larger conversation, the first draft of the history that's unfolding. What gave you the idea and the nerve to take it public?
I really just wanted to share these observations that even though the story on the surface of SARS-CoV-2 and SARS-1 in 2003, even though on the surface it looks kind of similar, that it occurred in the winter, is somehow connected to a market, like wild animals. Actually, when you look at the stories in detail, they are very different. And I just wanted to put those observations online in public. What happened after that, it really was like this black hole that drew me in. Like I could not escape. And so I think unofficially became, like you said, one of the channels or platforms by which these clues that they found could be translated to the rest of the world with someone who has a bit more credibility and a non-anonymous account.
You built an open forum, which is an amazing accomplishment. But what are the significant clues you've come on?
We, together with the internet sleuths and scientists, we are coming to an understanding that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was working with a batch of viruses very closely related to SARS-CoV-2. Again, there's no evidence that they were working with SARS-CoV-2 in the lab, but they definitely were working with a group of viruses that not only were very similar genetically to SARS-CoV-2, but also from a mine where people had sickened and half had died from a SARS-like illness. So back in 2012, this had happened in southern China, more than 1,000 kilometers away from Wuhan City. And it was so interesting to Chinese scientists that it drew in not just the WIV, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, it drew in the lab of the Chinese CDC director, it drew in a top pathogen lab in Beijing. It was followed up and consulted with Dr. Zhong Nanshan, who is the sort of like the Dr. Fauci of China. And so they were all going in there looking for the virus that had given these miners this severe respiratory disease. And the closest relatives to SARS-CoV-2, especially at the time when it just broke out in Wuhan, were all in the WIV's possession.
What were they trying to do with them? And what was the American presence in all that research then?
So this has to be told from the standpoint of the first SARS outbreak in 2003. So back then, they had almost immediately, within weeks of isolating the virus for the first time, they had found the intermediate host. They had found civet cats that also carried similar viruses. But at the time, they didn't know what animal, what reservoir, had first given the virus, the SARS virus, to these civet cats before it jumped into humans. So a team of scientists, international scientists, which included Dr. Xi Jingli at the WIV, as well as Dr. Peter Daszak of the Equal Health Alliance, the US-based, were tasked with finding the origins of SARS-1.
And what did they find?
So they did find the bad reservoir. Over the next decade, they traced it to a cave in Yunnan in South China, where the bad viruses there had very highly identical parts to the first SARS virus. So they speculated that the first SARS virus had been a recombinant, a mix of these viruses from that region at least. And somehow it made its way into the other southern Chinese province, Guangdong, into civet cats and humans. So this team of scientists, international scientists across China and the US, had been well known for their efforts to find the origins of the first SARS virus. They were given money to find more SARS viruses, especially those that cause disease, and characterize them in the lab so that we could prevent and prepare for the next pandemic.
How important was it to know that viruses can pass from bats through other, maybe smaller animals, adapted perhaps, on their way to human flesh?
I think this team had been looking for evidence of a direct spillover, direct transmission of SARS viruses from bats to humans. And up till today, there's no direct evidence of that, except for maybe those cases of the miners who had been working in the mine, surrounded by bats and guano, and they got extremely sick. But they never transmitted the virus to other people, as far as they could tell. They just each got extremely sick from spending long periods of time in that poorly ventilated mine, breathing in bat dust.
Antonio Regalado of the Tech Review, you've been here before in a strange way. You broke the story 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, about the Chinese doctor Hu Jiangqi, who had edited the hereditary germline of two CRISPR babies. It was another jumble of American and Chinese science, and grave rules had been broken in China to do what American science is longing to do someday. I mean, what's new and what's not in the COVID saga. Antonio.
The situations of the birth of these babies edited with CRISPR in China and the mystery around the origin of SARS coronavirus 2, I mean, the situations kind of rhyme, and they rhyme in the following way. China is an ambitious country in the domain of science. They want to be at the top of the heap or among those at the top of the heap, the US, Europe. They're very competitive in areas of cutting-edge research. Mm. So that itself, Nicholson sort of said, he mentioned, you know, what is the context in which this research is going on? And so the Chinese context is one of being in a hurry to get out ahead. And when you're hurrying and also working with, you know, potential pandemic viruses, that is an alarming situation. A lot of people don't like to criticize China for the way they do science, but I think it's something that has to be in the equation. Is this virus research being done in a way that's safe, in a way that's well documented?
You and I spoke around the time of the gain of function story, which was roughly a year ago, and we were both kind of intrigued. I was shocked. You pursued it like a great reporter. How did you account for the almost silent response of scientists who disapproved the work but weren't going to talk about it? Maybe didn't want to embarrass science, of all things.
My journey reporting was very similar to Nicholson Baker's, maybe almost identical. Finding people on Twitter like Alina who were talking about it, speaking to Richard Ebright, and then this group of people who had a pre-existing concern about gain-of-function research, the Cambridge Working Group.
Right.
The difference was that Nicholson actually wrote the article, and I didn't, but there's an important reason why, and it's in the first sentence of Nicholson's article. He writes, "What happened was very simple. I've come to believe it was an accident." And that phrase, "I've come to believe," I think was a kind of a crucial turning point. He's saying what he believes when he weighed the evidence. And since then, there have been several reporters, including two former New York Times reporters, who've published blog posts saying basically, this is also what they've come to believe. In my case, I was still hinging a report on what other people would believe and what other people were willing to say. And indeed, they didn't really want to talk about it on the record. It was just time consuming to get the sources, although, you know, in private, casually amongst friends, many of them, many scientists, believed that it was probably a lab accident. They might not have studied the evidence either, but that was their gut feeling.
Coming up, circumstantial evidence that tilts our thinking without ending all doubt. This is Open Source. Henry David Thoreau wrote famously that circumstantial evidence of human intervention can be very strong, as when you find a trout in a glass of milk. But it's not always conclusive. Our guests, Alina Chan of the Broad Institute between Harvard and MIT, Antonio Regalado of the Tech Review, and the novelist Nicholson Baker are talking about how they read the Wuhan evidence, which leaves a lot of room for interpretation and judgment. Nick Baker first.
I think circumstantial evidence can be crucially important, and there is, in fact, a very fascinating story that Alina was alluding to that is part of the circumstantial sort of, I wouldn't say a mountain, but there is a sizable mound of circumstantial evidence that there was this unfortunate situation in a copper mine, an abandoned copper mine in southern China. These men, six men, were shoveling bat guano, and they worked many hours every day, and they got very sick, and three of them died. And it was not a communicable disease, but that there was then a sampling program, as Alina described, that brought back these samples of both of the sick men and of the bats that may have been responsible for their illness to Wuhan. So what have we got? We've got a bat disease, the closest related bat disease. It is far away from Wuhan. There was no epidemic in Wuhan, so it wasn't catching. And then we have this disease appearing suddenly late in 2019 and with a record of this closest related bat virus being worked on in the place. So that doesn't mean that it's dispositive. It's certainly not proof, but it is crucially important to investigate everything about that line of research going on in Wuhan, not only in the Wuhan Institute of Virology, but in other labs in Wuhan, there are several others that were doing bat virus research in cooperation, and ask everybody to open their books. That's obviously what you need to do.
The question was what you can make of circumstantial evidence. Here's what you made into in a remarkable paragraph in New York Magazine last winter. You said, "I keep returning to the basic puzzling fact, this patchwork pathogen, which allegedly has evolved without human meddling, first came to notice in the only city in the world with a laboratory that was paid for years by the U.S. government to perform experiments on certain obscure and heretofore unpublicized strains of bat viruses, which bat viruses then turned out to be, out of all the organisms on the planet, they turned out to be the ones that are most closely related to the disease. What are the odds?" Antonio, what does that impress you? Is your thinking anything like that?
It does indeed. I think that that observation was made, you know, very early on, even in January of 2020, by scientists who work on coronaviruses. They noticed this fact of the coincidence that the pandemic is co-located in the same city with a lab that studies similar viruses. Later on, Alina and others have documented that closeness by learning more about other viruses or this family of viruses that the lab studied. I want to mention the anthrax case of 2000. This was shortly after September 11th, 2001. Somebody mailed anthrax to Tom Brokaw at NBC News, to Tom Daschle, then on Capitol Hill, with threatening letters that made it sound like it had been sent by, you know, a Muslim terrorist. And there also, this question of what was the most genetically similar anthrax became very important. Within just a couple of weeks, I had the chance to travel out to Arizona, where I met a group of scientists that had a large collection of anthrax, which they had stored. And they were able to say that the anthrax sent in these attack letters was actually related, or was a specimen of the U.S. strain, of the strain used in the U.S. bioweapons program. Hmm. Immediately, the question turned to whether it had come out of the U.S. program. And eventually, the FBI publicly accused the chief anthrax researcher at the at a lab called U.S. AMRID in Maryland of being the person who sent the anthrax. So I think the genetic similarity is a huge clue. It's huge.
Can anybody explain briefly, talking of circumstantial evidence, the point about the cleavage in this virus? It's a kink that makes it more powerful, and it targets it more significantly on the receptors of the human lung. We know that part of the mandate in the lab was to test the most powerful versions of a virus against humans. What do we make of that, that kink that looks to some people like it was contrived, it was made in a lab?
I think I better take this question.
Please.
Even David Baltimore was quoted. He's an extremely famous virologist, Nobel Prize winner. he won a Nobel Prize for his work in viruses. He read Nicholas Wade's article, and he told him this was a smoking gun. He said that's what he told his wife when he first saw the codon usage of that furin cleavage site. But since then, other virologists have put up their own analysis of it, countering why this is not really a smoking gun. And I could see this arising naturally. To me, the most revealing fact about this furin cleavage site is that it was not mentioned in the WIV, the Wuhan Institute of Virology's first paper characterizing the virus. So they had done a very careful dissection of this virus, comparing it directly to the spike of SARS-CoV-1 and the other SARS-like viruses in their database. But they did not mention this extremely functionally relevant site. Hmm. This was the first time a furin cleavage site had ever been observed in a SARS-like virus. They had dozens of these in their collection. SARS-2 was the first one to have this. They did not mention it. And the analogy I give people is like you discover a unicorn for the first time, and you compare it to other horses, describing in detail every other difference in their, you know, the hair, the hooves, the eyes, and you don't mention the horn. So that to me is the most revealing point on the furin cleavage site.
Alina, what would have been the purpose, scientific, medical, anything, of adapting a virus with this cleavage, this unicorn, so to speak?
So this had been done by several labs worldwide on different coronaviruses. Some labs in Wuhan had been doing it too. And like I mentioned, Dr. Xicheng Li at the WIV had collaborated with US scientists, including Ralph Barrick, to insert furin cleavage sites into a MERS-like virus. So they weren't doing this to create destructive pathogens. They were trying to see how such a furin cleavage site could affect the ability of the virus to infect different types of cells in your body. So lung cells versus kidney cells. It was not, I think in their eyes, a risky form of research. It was a way to understand the virus so that you can design therapeutics against such viruses.
Alina Chen, Antonio Regalado, Nicholson Baker. From the science to the sensibility around this story for a lot more than a year now, that scowl of Donald Trump lashing out at the China virus still hangs over our understanding, and it surely hung over the reporting of the whole story. It wasn't much science in his charge, but there was a lot of anger and an air of injury that lingers. Secretary of State Pompeo did the same. It came out of a lab, meaning it's a Chinese problem. Never mentioning, of course, that the United States had an investment in it. So to be pro-Trump at the time was to be anti-China, which made the lab leak story plausible and welcome. And conversely, to doubt the lab leak was to be anti-Trump. I wonder how you navigated through that thick suspicion and how we folk are still caught somehow in the political cast of the whole thing. Antonio, will we ever get out of the Trump characterization of the China virus? Can we? How do we do it?
Chris, like a lot of things that Trump said, people didn't like them, but he did have a genius sometimes of getting to the point, and it may be that in this case, you know, if it's a lab leak, then we have to going to reassess the things that Trump said about the virus.
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
I wonder, Alina, could I ask, how do you feel this ugly, sometimes violent, anti-Asian emotion that seems to be bursting out all kinds of places in our country now? And what connections do you make by way of explaining it?
Well, I think emotions are really high, and people want to make someone culpable. They want to blame someone. And sometimes the distinction between the Chinese government and people with Chinese descent, that distinction is extremely blur for some individuals. These violent acts and discrimination abuse, they come from a small number of individuals. But that small number of individuals have the power to really make life extremely unpleasant for people of Asian descent. Yeah, I've been advised and with good intentions that when I tweet, when I say things about the origins of COVID, I have to not only keep in mind rationally minded, you know, the majority of people, I have to think also about these extremists. So people who, intentionally or not, misunderstand the situation and want to blame Chinese people. Of course, this has nothing to do with people of Chinese descent living overseas or even in Wuhan City. Like, people in Wuhan can't control what's happening in the lab or what's happening in the markets. They are the first to be hit with this pandemic. It's in their interest not to have it happen again in their city. In that science letter that came out last week, we had to make this point clear. We didn't want our letter to be taken by the few extremists and used to fuel anti-Asian hate.
I want to come back to the matter of public understanding. We know about the fog of war, but can you remember any major event around which almost every official source was covering up, propagandizing, spreading suspicion, demagoguing, deceiving us? China has its own reasons to cover up its own embarrassment, maybe even to destroy evidence and to act like the totalitarian state it is. But I keep wondering, where is the citizen curiosity in controlling the story we inhale in the United States? Nick, you're out there in the imagination of this country. Antonio, you're a reporter too. I mean, how do we restore a kind of civility and trust in our public square?
So this is a worldwide problem. It was a worldwide collaboration of overambitious science that maybe gave us this thing. But it's also got to be something in which we all set aside whatever squabbles we have and sometimes really reasonable objections we have to governments and say, what can we do to get to a state where we're all healthier? And unfortunately, the problem is the inhibition in American scientists had to do with the fact that we were in a Trump regime in which the only good guy, supposedly, was Dr. Fauci. And Dr. Fauci, unfortunately, for the past 2 decades, really, has been funding the wrong kind of research. So he is a person who is obsessed with bio threats and bio terror, and he did what George Bush wanted him to do. And he's not a good guy in a lot of ways. He was the most reasonable human being at the public face of the Trump administration. But as a person who funded American research, he distorted and paid for things that were very risky, that hundreds of scientists wrote petitions about, saying, you are spending all this money on anthrax and all these crazy, obscure bioterror diseases when we've got people being sick of normal diseases, and that funding has gone down. So this is something that evolved over a long period of time, and it has to do with American scientists being nervous about criticizing the one supposed bright star in the Trump firmament, Dr. Fauci. That's what it's really about.
Accentuating the positive, I want to remark on the remaking of journalism, which I find completely fascinating. Among others, we have you three. We have former New York Times people Don McNeil, Nicholas Wade, back in action on Medium or freelancing. But Twitter, of all things, is at the center of this whole conversation. It's open source reporting, it's crowdsourced argument, professionals and amateurs. The coverage on Twitter, strange to say, is better than in the big league media. Is that fair, Antonio?
Chris, you definitely hear the news first on Twitter. And in terms of my own practice, I spend an inordinate amount of time on Twitter, and you find all kinds of sources just because they've liked a tweet that you've posted. It's also incredibly confusing and sort of ineffectual in some ways, because your job is to sort through all these different tweets and threads and see what you can find. I mean, it's not well organized.
It's the consensus that I listen for, and the tone and the direction.
When I post about the lab leak theory,
the
people who respond to that and who like it or add comments, I mean, it's not the best group of people, I would say. It's a lot of nuts. So, you know, to judge these tweets by the company that they're keeping, it's not that positive. And so that does give me pause. I mean, who is amplifying the lab leak question online? Alina is a serious scientist. Nicholson Baker has written a very well-researched article for New York Magazine. But it is still being amplified by a kind of trollish right-wing contingent who still have these other aims. And I just wanted to say also, a lot of scientists now are saying, well, it doesn't matter where it comes from. It could be the lab, but it doesn't matter. You know, we have to fight it and defeat the pandemic. And in some level, they're saying it doesn't actually matter that it came from the lab.
I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. The people who say that it doesn't matter for the world where this virus came from, I'm going to say that they have not sat down and really thought this through. And so I just want to point out again here that the people who think that this must have been natural, they're all also working with the fumes of circumstantial evidence. There's no direct evidence that this came from an animal. There's no evidence, no intermediate host found, even after a year and a half of searching. This question, it really matters a lot to China. Where did this virus come from? It hurts their reputation, both inside their own country as well as globally. It matters to them where this virus came from.
What I'm interested in is, you know, under what conditions or for what reasons might the Chinese government actually carry out and disclose the results of such an investigation? Can the benefits and the penalties of doing that, can they be weighed differently in a way that would make that possible? In the case of the CRISPR babies, of course, Dr. He was tried and convicted of impersonating a doctor and sent to prison because of this international outcry. In the end, it was better for China to solve the case and to put him away.
Gain-of-function research and all kinds of other scientific research is precisely noted. Where are the notebooks? And if the Chinese have destroyed theirs, where are the American notebooks on their part of the Wuhan lab?
And if there was a trustworthy investigation of the notebooks and interviewing of the people, a real forensic investigation, it would, I think, go a long way to diffusing the extreme paranoid wing of this whole bystander theory, which is that the evil Chinese soullessly cooked up a biological weapon and decided to cause chaos all over the world. And this was what some of the China haters were saying and continue to say and continue to believe. It wasn't a demonic, evil plan. It was what usually happens, which is somebody screwed up.
I just wanted to put my two cents in here, which is that a lot of this work that is forensic and investigative has so far been carried on the shoulders of internet sleuths and hobbyists like myself. And so there are so many gaps of knowledge that I think can be filled by having a proper, well-recognized international investigation that reaches out to everyone holding a little piece of the puzzle to see what is the overall picture. Even if we don't get a 100% like fully filled out puzzle, what is the most likely picture here? Is it from the lab or is it from animals in the wild? The Chinese government, maybe they know already where this came from, or maybe they also do not have access to information from the scientists who may have accidentally leaked it, right? So if this came from a lab leak from your lab, you're probably freaking out. It's not like you're going to tell your government that has the power to put everyone in your lab in a camp and their families that it came from accident in your lab. So it's possible that there are so many people with a little bit of knowledge and suspicions, and having a full investigation will bring us a lot closer to the origins of this virus.
Alina Chan, Nick Baker, Antonio Regalado, you've done worlds of good from my understanding in your writing and in this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Thanks.
Coming up, the lonely whistleblower among American virologists, troubled by safety standards, even the goals of virus research for more than a decade now. Richard Ebright next. This is Open Source. Richard Ebright is a decorated molecular biologist, 30 plus years a professor at Rutgers University. He's not the only American scientist who had misgivings about the construction and re-engineering of viruses under the general heading of what's called gain-of-function research, but he is the rare one who has spoken his objections loud and clear for a long time. The work is inherently dangerous, he told me this week, and maybe even pointless.
So the argument is made that it is useful to assess potential threats. That is to say, not to look at what viruses are currently infecting humans, but what viruses might come into existence perhaps 1 year from now, or 10, or 100, or 1,000, or 10,000 years from now. And the only way to do that is to collect large numbers of viruses that exist now, mix and match parts, perform other studies to assess which viruses are close to having pandemic potential, and what changes would push them over the line into having clear pandemic potential. So that is the rationale. So there's one element of rationale in terms of obtaining additional information about fundamental biology. There's one element of rationale in terms of assessing threats that might arise at some point in some time in the future. You might ask, is there a justification in terms of developing vaccines or drugs? There, the answer is a clear no.
Remdesivir.
No. So this work does not contribute in any way, shape, or form to the discovery or development of drugs or vaccines. When one develops a drug or a vaccine, one is developing it for an existing threat. One starts with an existing pathogen, develops drugs and vaccines that address it. One does not need to, and indeed one does not benefit from, constructing a new, not previously existing threat, and then developing a drug or vaccine for it. That's often cited as a rationale, but it is not a real rationale. Again, this category of research has produced no results, absolutely no results, that have contributed to our availability of drugs or vaccines.
Dr. Ebright, to a layman, it sounds like you're looking for trouble.
To a scientist, that's what it sounds like too.
So how did it take so long for that project and the rationale to surface in our news? It's barely in our news yet.
Well, it has been in our news since 2015, and those of us who have been discussing this project and dozens of others like it since that time and well before that time obviously thought of a laboratory accident scenario. So if I had heard of an outbreak anywhere in the world other than Chapel Hill, North Carolina, or Wuhan, or Galveston, Texas, where research of this type has subsequently been performed, I would have immediately concluded this was natural spillover, as has occurred for so many diseases in the past, standard historical origin of pandemics. But it happened in a city that does not have colonies of the species of bats that carry these bat SARS-related coronaviruses. And it happened in a city that has the world's largest collection of bat SARS-related coronaviruses, that has the bat SARS-related coronavirus closest in sequence to the outbreak virus, and that was carrying out a large and active program of bat coronavirus surveillance in wildlife and bat coronavirus gain-of-function research. And so anyone who has been engaged in these discussions over the last two decades immediately would have thought of this as a possibility.
Do we want to guess at a chance that the monster killer, COVID-19, came out of that lab?
It may have, and we do not know. At this time, there is no scientific or other secure data that allows us reliably to distinguish between the two possible routes by which this virus entered humans. Hmm. It may have entered humans in a natural accident upon contact of an infected animal with a member of the general public, or it may have happened in a research program upon contact of an infected animal or an infected sample or an infected laboratory animal with a researcher performing field collection or a researcher in a laboratory.
If it did leak out of the Wuhan lab, it'll surely be remembered as the worst accident in human history.
In human history.
Who's accountable? Who's responsible? Who's complicit?
If there was a lab origin, then the nations, the organizations, and the individuals who enabled the research and who allowed it to be performed in the manner in which it was performed would have at least some responsibility. So this is an incident that would have occurred in Wuhan, China, but it's an incident that would have occurred in the context of funding from other nations. The funding for the construction of the facility and for training of its personnel came from the government of France. The funding for additional training of personnel in the institution came from the government of the United States. And the funding for the SARS-related coronavirus surveillance and SARS-related coronavirus gain-of-function research came from the United States. And so this is not simply a matter of China's actions and China's decisions. This also engages the international community's actions and the international community's decisions, decisions to construct the facility, to train the personnel, to fund the research, and not to carry out a risk-benefit assessment for the facility or for the research, and not to specify a sufficient and adequate standard of biosafety and biosecurity for the institute and the research. And so it's not just China, and it's not just one institution in China, and it's not just one laboratory and its staff. This engages other players.
What does it tell us that it was an undertaking of many nations?
It tells us that this is not world versus China. This is not the U.S. versus China. This is a matter that engages decisions made both by the U.S. and by China and by France and by other nations. That has several implications. That means this should not be a source of international tension. It should not be a source for a call for reparations or punishments against a given nation. This was an international project. It also means that there are elements of the investigation and elements of steps that could be taken to reduce the risk of similar events that can be undertaken entirely within the United States, and which need to be undertaken entirely within the United States. Many threads a potential investigation are available here in the United States and need to be investigated. How was the decision made to fund this research? Why was the decision made to fund this research without performing a risk-benefit assessment?
Was there no such thing?
There was no risk-benefit assessment. There is, in the United States, implemented in December of 2017, a policy that requires a department secretary level review, department secretary level risk benefit assessment by a committee established by the funding agency's department secretary. That committee would contain individuals with expertise in national security, in defense, in intelligence, in biomedical research, in biological safety, in biological security, and in risk-benefit assessment. So a committee exists to carry out that review, but this project was not selected for this review. Indeed, almost no projects have been selected for review. So since the committee was established in 2017, federal policy has been in place to carry out the risk-benefit assessment. Nevertheless, only two projects out of literally dozens that would trigger or should trigger this review have been forwarded to committee for review. The funding agencies realized the very simple point that if they don't identify a project as requiring review, flag it and forward it, they can then fund it without anyone else's checking their judgment.
Sounds now as if scores, maybe hundreds of scientists knew all about this. You had a lonely post there until very recently opposing it. Where were the others?
Well, some scientists, many of the scientists who spoke out early, and it was a small group. It's important to emphasize it was a small group. Some two dozen scientists signed a joint letter as an op-ed, which was published in The Lancet in March of 2020, which set the narrative for assessing the origins of SARS-CoV-2.
How so?
The origins of the COVID pandemic. And that op-ed stated that the science tells us this was natural spillover. This, of course, was untrue. It was untrue at the time. It's untrue today. But two dozen scientists signed their name to it, and the press accepted it as a fact. Five scientists, also in March 2020, published an opinion piece in a scientific journal called Nature Medicine on the proximal origins of SARS-CoV-2. They also stated that in their assessment, the science tells them that the virus could not have had a lab origin. Again, it was untrue at the time. They presented no scientific evidence, no scientific data. They published a commentary, an opinion piece, but it was sold to the press and it was accepted by the press as a scientific paper presenting scientific data and making a scientific analysis. And between the Lancet letter and the Nature Medicine op-ed, a narrative was put in place. And although the facts have not substantively changed, it has taken a long time for that narrative to collapse of its own weight and for people to openly look at the facts. It's very important to emphasize that almost nothing new has been learned relevant to the origin since the first week of February 2020, or even since the last week of January 2020. There's only one element of information that has become available that is relevant, and that's information that relates to the location where the virus, the published virus closest in sequence to the outbreak virus, was first sampled. That information became available in March of 2020. So almost nothing has changed since January or February of 2020. Nothing has changed since March of 2020. But the narrative, the false narrative that was put in place at that time, has now collapsed.
We've been kept pretty well in the dark about this remarkable story. Was it propaganda? Was it suppression? Was it good faith in those denials a year ago?
Oh, I think it was very forceful denials of individuals who were directly involved in funding and supporting the work, or were receiving related funding, or were associates of those in those categories. They captured the narrative early. The press reinforced that narrative. And then several months later, in April of 2020, when Secretary Pompeo and President Trump made unfounded accusations against China and against the lab in China and could not follow up those accusations with, or would not follow up those accusations with, supporting evidence, at that point, that narrative was cemented even more strongly as the only sound narrative, and that to question that narrative was to support the Trump administration. So to overcome that second feature, it was necessary to replace the Trump administration. So after an election and after an inauguration of a new administration, that burden was removed. And that made it possible to reevaluate the facts that were in hand a year before. The farce of the WHO mission, which, as you recall, this spring, about the time of the inauguration, came back and proved itself to be a charade. a whitewash, an obvious whitewash, a transparently obvious whitewash, that coupled with the inauguration of a new administration, reopened the discussion. And the original narrative could not be sustained because it was a tissue of lies.
We're scared. We're chagrined. We're angry about this whole story. Who should we hold responsible?
We should not be looking at who's responsible. We should be looking about how do we reduce the risk of a future occurrence? How do we decrease the likelihood of a similar pandemic emerging? How do we mitigate the impact of such a similar pandemic? And we immediately need to take measures to address that. That's the urgent task. Accountability is not the urgent task. Mm-hmm. The urgent task is preventing SARS-3. We know now that this virus may have entered humans through natural spillover. We know now that it may have entered humans through research-related spillover. We need to take steps to reduce the likelihood of both of those two mechanisms of spillover and to reduce the impacts of spillover under both. We need to reduce contacts between humans and wildlife that potentially could result in natural spillover. And we need to implement national level and international oversight of the types of research that can result in research spillover, particularly the very highest risk virus surveillance in wildlife programs and the very highest risk gain of function research with viruses, those research programs. We need to increase biosafety levels substantially. We need to increase biosecurity levels. We need to ensure that high-risk research undergoes a risk-benefit assessment. We need to ensure that the national level measures that are in place in the U.S. but have not been followed are followed in the future. And we need to work with our partners overseas to coordinate international oversight of this research.
How do we score Dr. Fauci facing Rand Paul and saying the U.S. government, his U.S. government, never supported gain-of-function work on that virus?
His statement is demonstrably false. He was either uninformed or misinformed or seeking to deceive. He needs to correct that statement.
In the ranks of science, education, politics, media, who's going to lead us out of this morass, this horrific embarrassment?
Again, the correct framing is not an embarrassment. The correct framing is a tragic crisis, a crisis that we need to prevent in the future. We need to reduce the likelihood of a recurrence or reduce the impact of a recurrence. That means investigating the origins of SARS-CoV. That means carrying out a national and international investigation to try to determine the cause. And it means while that investigation is proceeding, not after it is finished, not after it might eventually result in a conclusion, but immediately identifying the vulnerabilities that could potentially have given rise to SARS-CoV-2, and eliminating those vulnerabilities. And a very large area of vulnerabilities concern biosafety, biosecurity, and biorisk assessment. Research that either should not be performed or should be performed with very strict risk mitigation procedures in place, but which currently is performed with no national oversight at all.
You say no national oversight?
None.
Who's our leader in the inquiry that you say is absolutely required immediately?
This has to come from our political system. The scientific community over the last year has shown that it is not capable or not willing to take command of the issue. So this has to come from our political system. It has to come from the White House or from the Congress. It needs to come from a unit that has subpoena power so that when it carries out an investigation or requests information, the request for information will be answered. It needs to be able to compel entities that have information to provide information. And most important, the changes in biosafety and biosecurity and biorisk assessment need to come from our political system, not from scientists. Scientists have been discussing this since 2003. And the product of that, nearly two decades of discussion, was the 2017 Potential Pandemic Pathogen Control and Oversight Framework. That was the framework that requires risk-benefit assessment, but which funding agencies have simply nullified. They've nullified it by not forwarding proposals for review under that framework. So two decades of discussion within the scientific community have proved only one thing, and that is that the scientific community will not self-regulate. That regulation will need to come from our political system.
Richard Ebright, I'm so glad we met you. I wish we'd met you a year ago, but this is important testimony. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, too, to Nicholson Baker, Alina Chan, and Antonio Regalado for thinking aloud with us. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from Chris Johnson and Michael Garth. Mary McGrath fights the consensus for all of us. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a collective of independent podcasts making some of the smartest audio you can find. This week, check out Iconography, a show about the icons, real and imagined, that define our sense of place. Host Charles Gustine visits the real Paddington Station in London as a way into a story about the fictional icon Paddington Bear, beloved by children of all generations. Listen at iconographypodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And learn more about the whole lineup of Hub and Spoke shows at hubspokeaudio.org.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.